Kevin Young, Hunter Water. Malcolm, the question of the debate going on at the moment in Goulburn and places like Toowoomba about the recycling of effluent to drinking water supplies. I wonder if you've got any thoughts on that. It is a debate that there's a lot of passionate people talking for either side.
Yeah, it's interesting. The debate is particularly passionate in Toowoomba, would appear. In Goulburn, and I know there's a table here from Goulburn, the Mayor Paul Stevenson, there he is. In Goulburn, doesn't appear to be any opposition or any concerted opposition. The reality is that wastewater, water, as I hope everyone in this room agrees, water should be judged on its quality, not its history. The issue is not. I mean, the reality, you don't. There's a lot of things you deal with, people, pets that you don't know where they've been, and you certainly none of us know where water's been. So the real question is, what is its quality when it leaves the tap into your glass or your pot or bathtub or whatever? And certainly we can recycle wastewater to a standard of much greater purity than any of the water we're drinking here today. There is a yuck factor. It's a sort of psychological thing in large measure. There has been a campaign against it in Toowoomba. We were in a position where we requested that Toowoomba have a referendum only because it's plain that projects of this kind have to have community support, and it just wasn't possible to say whether they did have community support in Toowoomba at that point. But I certainly have encouraged the Toowoombans to vote in favour of it. I certainly would be voting in favour of it if I was a resident. And yes, I have drunk plenty of recycled water from Singapore's New Water, and I suspect all of us have drunk a lot more recycled water than we imagine, particularly if you've ever drunk any water out of a water treatment plant that's on a river.
Oh, I'd rather defer to my chairman on the other side of the room, thank you.
Of course.
Thank you. Graham Dooley from United Utilities, also chairman of the AusSid Water Group. Malcolm, the reason that the urban water utilities don't invest the money in the sort of systems that you suggest is good old-fashioned politics. Sydney Water sticks into New South Wales Treasury a couple hundred million dollars a year. Water Corporation of Western Australia about $300 million a year. Where I live in South Australia, and I brushed my teeth in New South Wales sewage this morning before I got on the plane, that's $180 million a year. Now, without those dividends and tax equivalents going into state treasury, basically state treasuries have got a diabolical position in the affording of health and education and law and order and all those other great state responsibilities. No matter what you say about the logic and the economics and all of that, the water utilities themselves have got a diabolical problem in needing to sustain other state government services, but also, on the other hand, needing to invest in the sort of infrastructure that can do with recycling and desalination. How do you, as the federal government now, solve that problem? Do you instruct the states by some means, or do you put cash on the table? How do you motivate the state utilities to do the sort of things that you outlined?
Well, I think, Graham, I think politics and advocacy are very important parts of it. One of the reasons, thank you for, because you've endorsed the point I was making in my remarks. I think that most people do not understand the way in which water utilities have been run for cash. I really don't. I think if the voters of New South Wales understood that the principal reason they do not have the water they need is because Sydney Water has been starved of cash by its shareholder, and it's been run for cash, and all of us know what happens when you run businesses for cash and do not reinvest in plant or indeed even in people. If you don't reinvest, your business will run down, and you create a bigger and bigger liability in the future. Look, surely one great political commitment should be today that all of the surpluses from Australia's water companies will be invested in water. That's, you know, I'm not a passionate advocate of hypothecated taxes or anything like that. But given that we do have water shortages, why are we plundering our water utilities for cash? Why aren't we investing that money in water? If we did so, as you said, Graham, you would not have the supply issues that you have in your big cities today.
Are you going to do anything about that?
Well, you know, what can I, you know, what can I do? We can't nationalise Sydney Water. The Bill Heffernan's got his constitutional proposal, but at the end of the day, even if the Commonwealth Government had jurisdiction over water, Sydney Water is a large company that belongs to the state government. So, I think advocacy and using the various carrots and sticks that are at our disposal, which have been quite effective, as you know, with national competition policy. After the trading announcement was made at the MDBC Ministerial Council, I did a television interview with Carlene Maywald, who's the Minister for the Murray in South Australia, and someone said, well, you know, what? How did this come about? And she said, oh, well, the Commonwealth's very good with carrots and sticks. So, we do all of that, but I think the reality is that if voters want to pay a couple of hundred million dollars, want to allow Sydney Water, for example, to pay a couple of hundred million dollars a year to the state treasury, and they want to have the water they need, then maybe they should pay, maybe the water prices will have to go up, but the state government should be saying the reason the water prices are going up and up is because we're not just investing for the future, we're also using this state-owned business to fund our other activities.
Dennis O'Neill, Australian Council for Infrastructure Development. You mentioned quite a bit about management in your presentation, Malcolm, and I'd like to switch to the other side of that, which is picked up by Graham in his comment about investment. It's been an interesting week in Sydney for investors because we've heard a lot about the prospect or the actuality of the New South Wales government shredding the contract on the Cross City Motorway and giving investors quite a scare, if you like, about sovereign risk, political risk. It was an interesting week last week when the Commonwealth government did something similar in relation to the prospective sale of Snowy Hydro. What comment can you offer us as investors in this room about whether decisions like that, particularly the Snowy decision, are a function of the pendulum being reset due to either the iconic nature of water, or maybe it was the iconic nature of Snowy, but has the scene changed in relation to the prospect for greater private sector involvement in investment in water going forward as a result of these events?
Well, I don't believe so. I think Snowy is a very... Let me deal with Snowy first and then move on to the Cross City Tunnel. The Cross City Tunnel is just a bad deal. You know? I mean, it's got nothing to do with sovereign risk. The problem is, investing. It's when you invest, you build a road tunnel, a toll road, and you assume there's going to be 95,000 cars a day and you end up with 30. I mean, I don't know. I don't think that's got anything to do with politics. But I'll come back to the CCT, just on Snowy Hydro. We did not stop the sale going on. We said we were not going to sell 13%. We had a 13% stake. We chose not to sell our 13% stake. The state government in New South Wales could have continued with the sale had it wished. When they announced they were going to sell their 58% stake, you remember at the end of last year, they said they were going to do so regardless of whether we participated or not. As some of you would have read in the press, I was involved in the discussions that led up to that decision by the PM, and there was a difference of views as to what New South Wales would do. I mean, there was certainly not everyone was of the view that New South Wales would follow suit. The other thing about water is that Snowy is in a very different situation. It's not a water company in the way that Sydney Water is, or in the way that Graham Dooley's firm is a water company. You know, when you talk about the water industry, that covers enormous range of activities. Snowy Hydro is more like the Sydney Catchment Management Authority, or because it basically controlled a number of very large, it controls a number of very large reservoirs and is responsible for releasing a very large amount of water, which of course it has an in-stream use for, generating electricity. But in terms of the public interest in the rural sector, the major interest, of course, is that, you know, that 2,000-odd gigalitres running down, you know, the Murray and the Murrumbidgee, you know, 1,000 in each direction, thereabouts. One of the issues that was of some real concern to me and to the government was it became apparent to us about 3 weeks ago that the, and there'll be people here, I'm sure, that are familiar with the Snowy Water Licence, there is an algorithm in the licence which deals with the way in which the release of water is to be adjusted during dry periods or dry sequences. That formula does not work. Both MDBC and Snowy Hydro agreed it did not work and agreed that there was, and didn't work for either party, particularly didn't work for the farmers, and there was a need to negotiate a new formula. And that was apparent. The decision had been taken by New South Wales, who's, control had 58% of the company and owned the water and was the licensor under the water licence, taken the view that this should be dealt with after the IPO. Well, we took the view that that was something, that was certainly something that should have been dealt with well beforehand. But that's the kind of issue that you had with Snowy Hydro, a relatively a small factor, you know, if you like, almost a footnote in the prospectus, a tiny factor in the consideration of running Snowy Hydro as an electricity business, but an enormous issue if you are a irrigator on the, you know, Murray Valley or on the Murrumbidgee. Just turning to the CCT very quickly, the government, you know, firstly, the deal obviously has turned out to be a bad deal, but I mean, everyone, well, I don't know about everyone else here, I've made plenty of bad investments, so you can't, this just happens to be a particularly big bad investment as far as I can see. The real problem there, I think, is that transport is a network. And if you privatise a section of a transport network, a bridge or a tunnel or something like that, and then constrain other parts of the network, other roads and so forth, so as to benefit that particular part of the network, you may be saving some money in the state government's expenses because you've got this tunnel being built privately, but the cost of that tunnel is being paid for by the people who are being inconvenienced and who are being forced to use it. So, you know, I think it's obviously been an unhappy deal for the investors. I still struggle to imagine how a government could ever enter into a, in this day and age, enter into an agreement which in effect places disincentives for it promoting mass transit and, you know, minimising automobile congestion, which is obviously one of the biggest problems in our big cities and a huge economic cost. So, you know, cross-city tunnel, it's just a crook deal, I'm afraid.
So the second part of my question, though, you see the water sector as open as ever,
absolutely,
or as closed as ever to private sector
investment? I think it's, you know, but there's a... Well, you know, we have privately owned treatment plants here today. There are plenty of elements in the water sector which can be private. You know, France, which is not known for its commitment to the free enterprise culture, it's one of the more sort of statist countries in Europe, has had a privately owned water sector for 150 years. But the typical French contract, and I imagine there are some people here from the French water companies, involves the government or the community owning the infrastructure and the water company, in effect, managing them under a long-term contract. So I think there's plenty of scope. I'll be publishing a discussion paper on private sector participation in the water industry very shortly. and I hope we'll get lots of interest and debate about it. We take the very pragmatic view at the federal level that there are billions of dollars of investment needed in water in the years ahead, many billions of dollars, and we should be able to tap every type of capital, both public and private, to secure the investment that we need. But, you know, do I think Warragamba Dam's about to be privatised? No, I don't think so. And that's, you know, Snowy Hydro was more at that end of the, in terms of its water part of its activities, was more down that end of the spectrum than it was where, you know, Graham Dooley is, you know, running treatment plants and things of that kind.
Pam. Malcolm, Pam Allen, I'm chairman of the Natural Resources Management Committee in the New South Wales Parliament. Well, firstly, I think congratulations are in order because I think that you certainly have given the issue a focus since your appointment, which even though I'm sure many practitioners here would argue it's their primary issue, I don't think politically it has been perceived as that. And I think you've certainly contributed to the debate being elevated to a very significant level. That's on the national scene. So congratulations.
Thank you, Pam.
You mentioned desalination a couple of times in your speech as a solution, and I'm not being flippant because I agree with you. I think it is on the agenda of solutions. But how do we persuade the Sydney public, or at the very least the Daily Telegraph, that it's a solution?
Well, I think it's I'm not an advocate of desalination. I was quite critical of the proposal at Kurnell, but largely on the basis that I think you should really be exhausting your recycling options before you rush into desalination, both on cost and environmental grounds. And I'd just make this point about recycling. Every water project, or just about every water project, has externalities, you know, costs or benefits that are external to the transaction. And, you know, one of the externalities of a desalination plant is obviously your using a lot of power, you know, burning a lot of coal. Everything needs power. You know, they've got to have power to run this hotel and run this microphone. There's also a brine stream to be disposed of, which gives rise to environmental concerns, depending on the environment, the air, the type of ocean that's being returned to. But with recycling, there is one very, very big positive externality. And that is that every megalitre of wastewater that you recycle is a megalitre you're not putting into the river, into the ocean, you know, back into the environment. So there is a very big plus. If we believe we should dispose of our waste responsibly, and we clearly spend a lot of money doing that. I mean, it's not so long ago that sewage was being pumped into Sydney Harbour, and then we started pumping it into the ocean, and then we got sick of it coming back on Bondi Beach. So adopting that great engineering principle that dilution is the solution to pollution, we pumped it 2 kilometres further out to sea. With the benefit of hindsight, it's a pity a decision to recycle wasn't made then. But, you know, desalination will be a feature of Australia's water industry. It is now. There's a plant, I think it's a 45 or 50 gigalitre a year plant, in Perth that is about to come on stream. BHP are going to build a plant of at least that size at the top of the Spencer Gulf to provide water for their uranium mine at Olympic Dam, and there will be others. But I think we should look very, very serious. We should be much more committed to recycling. There is only one city in Australia that recycles a significant percentage of its wastewater, and that's Adelaide, and it's only 25%. Ultimately, these things will have to stack up. That the virtue of desalination, from my point of view, is that it provides a benchmark, because you know that anywhere on the coast of Australia where you've got access to power, you can create, 1,000 litres a cubic metre, a tonne of water on a levelised cost basis of around, $1.20, say, at the factory gate. You can be pretty confident of that. And that gives a great benchmark against which you can measure other things. And if they're significantly more expensive than that, there's got to be some justification for it.
Bill Herditch, I'm a guest of GHD today, who've been mentioned a couple of times. Malcolm, thanks very much for your wide-ranging speech. My question relates to the question of title. And you mentioned entitlements, but much of the political debate and acrimony over water to date has revolved around who owns what water when, and much of the debate at the moment at the federal level, at least involving, say, the Living Murray and others, which are, I understand, fixed policies, involve buying back title, owning water and buying title. It's not beyond the wit, though, is it, of institutions and governments and people to actually have more flexible ownership models, options, for example, and others, where water is applied in different places at different times when it is needed. Is the National Water Commission and the NWI, for that matter, interested in more flexible ownership title models for water?
Well, I was actually discussing this today with some water people that were much more knowledgeable than me, which is true of virtually everyone in this room, I should add. The only time I should say I've spoken about a subject where I know so much less than the audience is recently when I was in Rome at the World Youth Day, and I ventured into the field of theology addressing a group of clergy, but my speech was short, so you know, the shorter the speech, the more able you are to get over these problems. Look, you're absolutely right. The point, let me put this in context. The Living Murray initiative is a commitment by the Murray Darlings, you know, the southern states, South Australia, Victoria, New South Wales, and the Commonwealth, obviously, to acquire 500 gigalitres of permanent water by 2009 for the purpose of supporting six iconic environmental sites, you know, which include, there's six of them, obviously, but they're principally floodplains you know, the Barmer Millewa Forest is probably the one that everyone's most familiar with, and that the agreement is to acquire permanent water. Now, the point that Mr. Herditch is making, which is a valid one, is that a number of people have said, look, these places actually don't need water, obviously, all year round. In some cases, with the forest, you actually want to keep the water out. They should only be flooded occasionally. And you have to build infrastructure to do that. What is needed is not so much raw volume of water, but timing of water and, you know, quality and so forth. And indeed, they need most water when there's a flood, you know, when there's plenty of water. They don't actually need it in the dry years because the Australian landscape is used to not being watered in the dry years. And, you know, one of the criticisms of regulated rivers is that because we're storing all the water in the storages and we want to run the river in a regular way for the benefit of irrigation, you're not getting the regular floods that spread out over the landscape, the beneficial inundations. This is, you know, a particular problem in the rivers on the New South Wales-Queensland border, you know, and you will have heard the complaints of, you know, the graziers in Brewarrinashire and Wilmeringal and places like that about the consequences of Cubby Station. So the argument goes, rather than buying permanent water, why not just get options to acquire water when the farmers have got more water than they need? And because, paradoxically, when they've got more water than they need, that's when you actually need the water for the environmental sites. Look, I think there's a lot of validity in that, and it is very much on the agenda. But nonetheless, the government's commitment and the government's commitment is to acquire 500 gigalitres of permanent water as a first step. I don't think there'll be any change to that, but whether any more permanent water would need to be acquired after that is, you know, something will be debated, and the type of solutions you're talking about will be very much in the forefront.
We'll take one more question.
Howard Crozier, New South Wales Farmers Association. We've just had or are still having what's been called a 100-year drought. I think we had a 100-year drought in the early 80s. We had a 100-year drought in the middle of the 60s. We definitely had a 100-year drought in the Second World War. I think there was one between that period and that really monster 100-year drought that lasted from 1895 to about 1910. So I think the classic 100-year drought is probably a 20 or 25-year one. Now, people are saying, every time we have a drought, people say this is the worst one we've ever had, even though it's a 100-year drought. This time, we're blaming climate change for the severity. And these days, the term climate change or global warming is synonymous for human-induced warming. So if there's something in this, perhaps we need to calibrate the human effect and the normal cyclical effect, and I think a lot of work needs to be done about that. Also, there appears to be subjectively a progression in these issues. My colleagues and I definitely believe, subjectively, that the current drought is different in that water levels and water storages are much lower than they've ever been before.
Yeah.
Now, this is possibly because there's more people using the water, but some of us in more isolated areas, we notice that things are drier. Mm-hmm. Our springs have dried up. So the next time we have one of these 100-year droughts in about 20 years' time, it might even be drier still. So a bit of a mixture of things, Malcolm, but would you like to make a comment on that?
Yeah, well, I just giving you a personal insight, I'm not sure what part of the country your place is, Howard, but...
Southern Tableland.
Pardon?
Southern Tableland.
Southern Tableland, okay. Well, in 1982, my father was killed in an aeroplane crash, and he left me with his cattle property in the Hunter Valley, and it was a very bad drought. But that was a 100-year drought, and it was terrible, and sort of all the catastrophes were happening at once. The current drought in the Hunter is much, much worse than the 82 drought. No comparison. I'm very aware of that. I think we all are. I think our climate is changing. Whether and to what extent it's induced by human intervention, we don't have enough time to debate that, but clearly we have to deal with the consequences of climate change. I mean, to give you a statistic that many of you will have heard before, but it's a pretty scary one. In the last 10 years, the stream flow into Perth's dams has declined by 64%. 64% for a big city. Looking at it another way, in the last 30-odd years, while the city's doubled in size just about, their surface water has been reduced by two-thirds. So I think we have to live with constraints on the consequences of drought. We often talk about the tough times the irrigators have, and obviously Doug Miles here somewhere, and the irrigators do have a tough time, but if you're a dry land farmer like you are probably, and certainly like we are, when it stops raining and there's nothing to eat, you're out of business. So it is very, very challenging. And the problem is, if you can't make it rain and you can't move water around at an economic price, it means that there are some parts of our agricultural world that are going to be, that are doing it tough now, that will be even more marginal in the future. And it is very troubling. But we just have to hope that it will rain. But in particular, in the areas where we do have water, and we do have water, it must be used as productively and as efficiently as possible.
More research on climate change.
Pardon?
More research on climate change.
Yeah, well, there's an enormous amount of work being done on climate change, and obviously, everyone knows from the PM's remarks, I mean, it's the climate change is the backdrop to the whole debate about nuclear energy. That's why we're having the debate about nuclear energy, and not just in Australia.